CT stud, cricketer for Christ in China and the Congo. As we seek to win Africa for Christ, to put feet to our faith, we can learn from an example of excellence. CT stud, Charles Studd, a cricketer for Christ who served in China, India and the Congo. Now, I've got two main sources for this. I've got one book, CT Studd, Cricketer and Pioneer, written by his son-in-law, Norman Grubb. And whenever you see the yellow text, it comes from that book. And then I've got Reluctant Missionary, written by his third daughter, Edith Buxton. And whenever you see the white text, it is derived from her book, Reluctant Missionary. One of the most delightful and brutally honest and humorous missionary biographies I've ever read. Edith Buxton was one of four daughters of the famous English cricketer turned pioneer missionary, Charles T. Studd. C.T. Studd had captained the Eton and the Cambridge cricket teams and then had played for the All English in Australia. He was converted during the Evangelical Revival of 1880 under the ministry of D.L. Moody. He gave up everything and went as a missionary to China in 1885. There he met Priscilla Stewart, and all four of their children were born in the heart of China. C.T. Studd was the third of four sons born to Edward and Dora Studd. Edward Studd was dead serious about horse racing. Not content with winning several steeplechases, he set his heart on the Grand National and won this race with his horse Salamander. Charles Studd was raised in great privilege in England. From his earliest years, he was involved in sports, particularly fox hunting, horse racing, and cricket. Aside from horse racing, the Studd family engaged in hunting in the winter and cricket in the summer. Edward Studd had a first-class cricket pitch made at the back of his house, or should we say estate. His three eldest sons grew up to achieve fame at Eton, which is the most privileged high school you can imagine in England, by all being in the cricket 11 together. And in fact, Charles, along with his two elder brothers, received the most exclusive education in the country at Eton, where they excelled at cricket and created a record when each brother captained the Eton cricket team in succession. I mean, when has that ever happened before? But then again, who else is brought up with a cricket pitch in their backyard? Life was very pleasant, comfortable, and promising for the boys until their father, Edward Studd, heard D.L. Moody, the great American evangelist. And nothing was the same after Edward Studd became a Christian. It was 1876. Edward was invited to hear the American evangelist D.L. Moody, Dwight L. Moody. This is the salesman turned evangelist. Moody's sermons were described as very much to the point. Edward Studd was 56 years old when he attended Moody and Sankey's outreach in Drury Lane Theatre. It was a decisive experience. He experienced a radical religious conversion. His whole way of life was changed. In order to express his new faith with all the energy and enthusiasm of which he was capable, he gave up all questionable pursuits, particularly gambling, and he invested his immense wealth and influence into winning others for Christ. The boys were shocked at the change they saw in his father. He withdrew from horse racing, then rode around the countryside to urge his neighbors to come into the Sunday meetings. They came in the hundreds, filling the staircases up to the first floor, leaning over the balconies to hear the fellows he got to come from London to speak to them. Moody himself came to the stud home and to their evening outreaches to the neighbors. As Edward had never done anything by halves, he now threw himself into saving of the souls of his friends and relatives. The evangelical message of those revival days was forthright and delivered by Edward was more like a sword thrust than a message. Are you saved? If not, you're going to hell. And that's a fact. He spoke fearlessly to everyone and anyone on salvation through trusting in Christ. He gave generously wherever there was need, even to the gift of a house in America to his friend D.L. Moody, when he contributed largely to the founding of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago for the training of missionaries for the foreign field. Edward lived for only 2 years after his conversion, but it was said of him that in those 2 years, he had worked wholeheartedly for the kingdom of God on earth and accomplished more than most Christians do in a lifetime. C.T. Studd studied at Cambridge and then When his second brother George was seriously ill and believed to be dying, C.T. considered, what is all the fame and flattery worth? Vanity of vanities, what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world but if he loses his own soul? Edith Buxton describes her father, who was known by his initial C.T. He was the third son of Edward Studd. C.T. captained the Eton 11 in 1879 and the Cambridge University 11 in 1882. Later, he was an English team that went to Australia to retrieve the Ashes. Now, if you know about the Ashes, what happened is when Australia beat England at cricket, the English team burned the cricket stubs and put them in a trophy and handed them to the Australians. And so this is why to this day it's called the Ashes. So the Ashes of England's glory was handed over to Australia. And so C.T. Studd was part of the English team that went to Australia to retrieve the Ashes and retrieve God's honour. England's honour. They brought back the Ashes in this trophy back to England. It's just a silver urn. But nevertheless, this is symbolic of major amounts of rivalry in cricket between England, Australia, of course, later India, New Zealand and South Africa and so on. And this is the English team that went all the way through to Australia. You can see the gentleman of England, C.T. Studd, at the back row, standing, arms folded on the right. Charles' fame grew and he was declared to be the best all-round cricket player in England. So he was the greatest cricketer of his era when England was the greatest empire in the world. So Charles Studd had the world at his feet. While on a cricket tour in Australia, his brother George came close to death through a severe illness, and this affected Charles. Edith remembers her father describing his conversion in these words. I had the good fortune to meet a real, live, play-the-game Christian. It was my own father. But it did make one's hair stand on end. Everyone in the house had a dog's life of it until they got converted. He was always asking about assault, and we did not like it. Attending a meeting of D.L. Moody, C.T. Studd was brought to a position of full surrender to Christ. And from this time on, his life was never the same, and he was possessed with a consuming passion to lead people to Christ. His brother George did recover, and C.T. went to hear Moody once again. As a result, he gave up cricket and dedicated himself to saving souls. It's interesting today that great Christians in sports bow for prayer at the beginning or the end of the match, or put some kind of Christian witness maybe on their face paint or something. In Charles Studd's day, a great Christian cricketer gave up cricket and went to China as a missionary. Charles now regarded his first 6 years of being a Christian as being in a backslidden state. Now he yearned to be absolute in his service to the Lord. C.T. shocked his family when he became one of the famed Cambridge Seven missionary volunteers of the China Inland Mission. Now, Cambridge is famous for being the university that produced the reformers that Oxford burned. Cambridge is the reformers' university. It produced the greatest reformers of England, everyone from William Tyndale to the first Archbishop of Protestant Archbishop of Canterbury, Archbishop Thomas Cranmer, and Ridley and Stott, all of these great Latimer, the greatest of the reformers in England, all seem to have come out of Cambridge. And so in Cambridge, they have a saying, Cambridge produced the reformers whom Oxford burned, which is not actually an exaggeration. Well, out of Cambridge now came seven of the most celebrated missionary volunteers ever. He met Hudson Taylor and answered the call to be a missionary to China. In this, he is joined by six other Cambridge students who made a huge impact on the secular and the religious world, becoming religious celebrities known as the Cambridge Seven. I mean, these were front page newspaper stories. He chose to join Hudson Taylor's mission to China. C.T. was described as no orator, but he was tireless and he had a forthright manner of speaking. These seven young aristocrats, two of them famous athletes, another two were military officers, forsaking the comforts of England to work with an until then unknown missionary society in the hinterland of China, was a story that press could not pass up. The Cambridge Seven helped catapult the China Inland Mission from obscurity to embarrassing prominence and inspired hundreds of other recruits for CAM and other mission societies. Now, the film we saw on Hudson Taylor last night never got that far. It was just dealing with the early years of Hudson Taylor's ministry, but those days just transformed when he recruited the Cambridge Seven, because these were some of the most privileged young people in England from some of the most prominent families from the greatest university, and before you knew it, China and their mission was one of the biggest and best supported missions on the planet. Stanley Peregrine Smith was the captain of the Cambridge rowing team, thus one of the most famous men in England. Even to this day, the rowing teams of Cambridge and Oxford in competition, I mean, this is like the most important part of the university year. And it's as brutal as what rugby or cricket competitions down here in South Africa would be. The Cambridge-Oxford rowing teams, they were the focus of the entire university's energies, was to beat their rival university in rowing. So he's the captain of the rowing team. He was also converted at a D.L. Moody revival, and he helped found the Cambridge Christian Union. Stanley Smith was the orator of the Seven. Dixon Hoster was the son of a major general, also an officer in the Royal Artillery, and also converted during the Moody campaign. He gave himself to Christ as completely as he gave himself to soldiering. Cecil Polhill Turner was an officer in the Royal Dragoons, that's the cavalry. His brother Arthur was studying to become a minister. William Wharton Castles was an ordained Church of England minister. And Charles Stubb was the most famous of all as the unbeatable cricket captain, the most brilliant member of a well-known cricketing family, to quote the local newspapers. With much fanfare, these missionary celebrities toured the British Isles, attracting huge crowds and much media coverage. Now, perhaps some of this went to their head, because on the long boat journey to China, they refused to study and prayed to receive the Chinese language supernaturally. Hudson Taylor warned them that this was one of Satan's devices to keep the Chinese ignorant of the gospel. And when they finally reached China in 1885, and the Chinese language had not miraculously descended upon them, they finally knuckled down to study. Would it have been better if they'd used those months on board ship for a bit of Mandarin study, but there we go. In China, they were immediately struck by the degradation that opium had dragged so much of the population down to. And they must have been quite distraught to know that the Royal Navy had helped the Rothschild enterprise of smuggling in opium in order to make the Chinese dependent on them to create a market. Very unethical, absolutely disgraceful, the opium trade, which was run by the British Rothschild bankster family. Many people in China had sold everything, furniture, roof tiles, agricultural tools, even their wives and children were sold into slavery to satisfy their cravings for drugs. One of the strategies of Cambridge Seven was to seek to reach these opium addicts for Christ. They established opium refuges, where addicts could come to stay for 3 or 6 weeks and find deliverance from this addiction. It takes at least 3 weeks to break bad habits, which is why we try to have Great Commission courses to start some good habits, like PT, daily devotions, mountain climbing, outreaches. Each of the Seven reacted very differently to China. William Cassells, the ordinary clergyman, was appalled by the lack of church rules. And within a year, he and Arthur Polwell Turner left CM and founded a Church of England diocese in Sichuan. Cecil Polwell Turner also left RDA and became a wandering missionary with the goal of being the first missionary to Tibet. Stanley Smith was soon casting out demons and offended the local Chinese Christians, abandoned the unobtrusive CIM style, and began parading through the villages with banners and gongs like a Salvation Army band. He eventually embraced the Buddhist ideal of the larger hope that all humanity will somehow be saved. And ultimately, Smith departed from the doctrinal foundations of the China Inland Mission so seriously, he was compelled to resign. Dixon Hoster was the most stable and successful of the Seven. He stayed the course as a wise, patient missionary, serving the Chinese with great distinction and earning their love and their trust. Dixon, in fact, succeeded Hudson Taylor as the next director of the China Inland Mission. Now, in China, Charles Stubb married an Irish Salvation Army officer, Priscilla Stewart. From the beginning, they suffered severe persecution, and he later reported that their first 5 years in China, every time they stepped out of doors, they were greeted with curses. So when it comes to xenophobia, the Chinese wrote the book. In fact, foreign devils are compound now. They don't refer to foreigners except as devils. foreign devils and blue-eyed devils, I mean, this is the kind of terminology out there. To cope with such hostility, a sense of humor is essential, as seen in these examples. C.T. Studd presented this parable. Remember the miller's donkey. The miller, his son, and his donkey went to market. The miller rode the donkey all the way, and the people exclaimed, "Cruel man, riding himself and making his son walk." So he got down, the son rode. And the people exclaimed, "What a lazy son for riding while his poor old father walks." So both father and son rode, and the people said, "Cruelty to animals, poor donkey." So they got down, carried the donkey on a pole, and the folks said, "Now here are two asses carrying another ass." Then all three walked, and people said, "What fools to have a donkey and not to ride it." So C.T. Studd said, "Let us get ahead with our work for God and not care what folks say." In other words, they're going to criticize you no matter what you do. As C.T. Studd said, "Had I cared for the comments of people, I should never have been a missionary." It's not a way to be popular. Nevertheless, Charles saw many people converted and numerous opium addicts delivered. His total dedication to China Inland Mission's principle of living by faith was seen that when he inherited a fortune of £25,000, which would be several million dollars today, he promptly invested it in the Bank of Heaven. He gave it away. He gave away his entire inheritance as gifts to the Salvation Army, Dale Moody's Bible College in Chicago, and to George Miller's orphanage. Just gave it away. And by the way, when his wife received an inheritance, she gave it away too, and he encouraged her not to. And she says, "I'm not going to let you have all the fun, and you're not going to be the only one who lives by faith around here." He preached Christ as though he would never preach it again, and he preached as a dying man to dying men. He gave to George Miller's orphanage, which was phenomenal. And if you ever read about George Miller's orphanage, all sustained by faith. There were times there was no food. They sat down the tables to give thanks for the food. By the time they said amen, there was a knock at the door. Snowstorm had kept the baker from delivering the bread. And he says, "Well, you know, I can't deliver these." So he gave them away. And all sorts of things. And amazing answers to prayer. He enabled Dale Moody to build the Moody Bible Institute. I mean, his donation was essential. General William Booth was able to send 50 Salvation Army missionaries to India on the support that he got from C.T. Studd's donation. When, after 10 years in China, he was invalided home with typhoid, his friends doubted whether he'd ever reach England alive. "There goes a dying man," the people said. However, C.T. did recover, but he suffered with asthma for the rest of his life. In spite of his physical strength as an athlete, Charles did not enjoy good health in the mission field, which had all kinds of challenges. And in 1893, he almost died. He was forced to return to England with his wife and four daughters who had all been born in China. When, in 1895, he returned from China, his family tried to persuade him to join the Church of England. But he dug in his heels. Father was not like that. He was not a man to join one particular church. He believed in any church or community who loved Jesus Christ in sincerity, wrote his daughter. C.T. traveled around Britain, stirring up interest in missions, and in 1896, he was invited to the United States to help launch the Student Volunteer Movement, the Student Volunteer Missionary Union, out of which grew the Student Christian Movement. He stayed in the United States for an 18-month speaking tour. Phenomenal. Sometimes addressing as much as 6 meetings in a single day. Many hundreds offered themselves for missions as a result. You cannot underestimate the importance of missionaries like C.T. Studd and Hudson Taylor mobilizing so many hundreds of others into the field, which helped make the 19th century the greatest century of missions. In 1900, C.T. Studd moved to India, where he pastored a church for 5 years. He also joined a cricket tour in order to have more opportunities to preach to soldiers. In India, he had the privilege of baptizing his four daughters. And one of those present at the baptism was the famous Amy Carmichael, seen here with a cat. Amy Carmichael is the one who was rebuked by her mission for being distracted by worldly matters like saving bodies. She spent a lot of time rescuing children from the temple cults and from the temple prostitution, all these other evils. And they said that she should confine herself to spiritual pursuits. And Amy Carmichael said, "Souls are more or less firmly attached to bodies. It's hard to serve the soul without serving the body as well. And Amy Carmichael is quite a character. Edith Buxton described this Indian summer as our happiest childhood. There were picnics, badminton parties, outings, morning rides, two by two with father. Father was keen that we should excel in outdoor sports, and he did his best to make riders out of us. These are days of monsoon, days of brilliant sunshine at an altitude of 8,000 feet. Now, the British chose high altitudes because, of course, less disease, cooler climate, and so on. Sometimes they saw tigers in the nearby jungle. Ill health again forced CT to return to England, where his sporting fame still enabled him to draw large crowds. These he addressed in his usual blunt manner. I once had another religion, hunting the Bible for hidden truths, but no obedience, no sacrifice. Then came the change. The real thing came before me. Soft speech became crude salt. The parlor game became real cricket. Words became deeds. The commands of Christ became battle calls, not merely Sunday recitations, but battle calls to be obeyed. Ascent to creed was born again into decisive action of obedience. Upon their return to England in 1906, the girls were shipped off to school in Switzerland, finishing school, where they learned French. As Edith put it, born in China, home to England, 5 years in India, followed by 1.5 years in Switzerland, and now Sorbonne. She described feeling guilty that she didn't want to follow her parents. Secretly, I felt at war with myself. Undecided, reluctant to throw in my lot with them. Yet I felt a stranger to the world that was shouting its welcome. And poor father groaned when he took us out, because being a missionary, it was not seemly to have such daughters. As to jewelry, we could never pass a shop without flattening our noses against the windows. Dorothy was always the favorite, anyway with the boys. I felt life was simply not worth living unless it could gain the same attention. There were constant jealousies between us. We were often at loggerheads. We had come to love the sounds of London. Edith Buxton describes the years leading up to 1914 as a brilliant decade of strawberries and cream and cricket matches and large hats and lace umbrellas. Night parties. Her elder sister, Grace, was always protecting us and, if need be, taking the blame. In 1908 in Liverpool, a notice caught CT's eye. His friend, missionary Carl Kuhn, was advertising his meetings with a post announcing, "Cannibals want missionaries." And Charles laughed, "For more reasons than one," he said. CT stood determined to take up the challenge. His doctors were against it. His wife was against it. His financial circumstances were against it. But he was convinced that God was for it, and that was enough for him. Muslims were sweeping down across Africa, making converts. And unless a chain of mission stations could be made across the center of Africa, nothing else could stop them. Father wanted to start the first mission in the middle of this chain, plumb in the heart of Africa. As Edith described it, it sent my grandmother crying and my mother weeping silently on the third floor of the Hyde Park Gardens. Her helpless cries, "Oh, Charlie, how could you?" Were of no avail. He set about speaking everywhere that he could get an opening in order to collect recruits. No offer of speaking did he turn down. He slept anywhere. In 1910, at age 50, he left alone for southern Sudan to explore the possibilities in equatorial Africa, joining CMS missionary Bishop Llewellyn Gwynne, the very same Llewellyn Gwynne after whom our Bishop Gwynne College is named in South Sudan, where our mission set up our base and restored the Bishop Gwynne College, which was in ruins, and established our base, school, college, and clinic. Out of 29 donkeys that went on this expedition, 25 died. That's how harsh the conditions were. Out of this journey, the vision for the Worldwide Evangelization Crusade, or WEC, was born. Although first he called it Heart of Africa Mission. He literally put a map of Africa, he drew a line from top to bottom, north to south, from east to west, and he said, "We're going to go smack in the middle." Didn't know what was in the middle, but he's going to go there. He came back to England as a man on fire. And once more, the students there were aroused by his meetings, and he wrote booklets in his usual hard-hitting, straight-from-the-shoulder style, including The Chocolate Soldier, which was quite a story. So I actually reprinted it in full, and we've got copies of them out on the table if you want to read a typical or classic C.T. Studd message. C.T. Studd wrote, Christ's call is to capture men from the devil's clutches, to snatch them from the very jaws of hell, to enlist and train them for Jesus and make them a mighty army for God. But this can only be accomplished by red-hot, unconventional, unfettered, Holy Spirit religion, by reckless sacrifice and heroism in the foremost trenches. It stirred up antagonism as well as inspiration. You can see his picture here of the chocolate soldier. He's reckoning that many of the soldiers in the church today are chocolate soldiers. They're like bonbons. They melt in front of opposition. He's talking about softies are. So if you think he thought that about the people of Edwardian England, what do you think he would say about the people of today? However, his doctor declared him medically unfit for any kind of missionary work. His great saying was, if Jesus Christ be God and died for me, no sacrifice could be too great for me to make for him. In 1911, he presented his chocolate soldier message at the Cambridge University. And the dons, that's the lecturers, they filed out in silent disapproval, but the undergraduates were intrigued with his audacity. Edith comments, to me, my father's goings-on were quite incomprehensible. As a family, we had had enough adversity. To go out and seek more was sheer madness. There is no doubt that he was a man of extraordinary vision and compelling presence. His messages were charged with challenge, humor, and emotion. But it was his realism and living out his own message that attracted those who looked for sincerity in a world of fashionable poses. It was at this stage that Edith's fiancé, Alfred Buxton, who was studying at Cambridge to become a doctor, volunteered to join C.T. Studd's Heart of Africa mission. In fact, the way Edith Buxton describes it, she innocently took her fiancé along to one of her father's meetings, not knowing that he would unfurl his Heart of Africa mission plan and see her fiancé go forward as the only volunteer for his mission. And this placed some severe strain on their relationship. She writes, naturally, this caused a hue and cry from the Buxton family, who said how unwise it was to go with this hair-braided man, as some called him. At the farewell meeting in 1913, at which C.T. and Alfred Buxton were to speak, C.T. spoke with his usual aplomb and zest. The difficulties were as great, but he did not care a brass button. As Edith commented, off to Africa they went, one too old and the other too young. In 1913, they set out again to Central Africa, this time accompanied by his daughter's fiancé, young Cambridge graduate Alfred Buxton. Together, they were the pioneers of what was then called the Heart of Africa Mission, but would soon be changed into WEC, Worldwide Evangelization Crusade. They followed in the footsteps of Henry Morton Stanley through Kenya and Uganda to northeastern Congo. Soon, Edith was again in the swim of my frivolous life. Tea as you only find in Scotland, scones of every kind, butter and glass dishes, homemade jams, and cakes baked to perfection. Fun and laughter were everywhere. Life was bright and gay. How easy to stay and be caught up in this life of grace and ease. Edith volunteered to work in the Salvation Army Mother's Hospital and worked in the wards for 6 months. Learning all I could, the first baby case I attended in the theatre laid me low on the floor. I think fainting was more common when you had to wear these girdles or corsets. Landing in Mombasa, C.T. Studd and Alfred Buxton travelled by bicycle through to the Congo. Father trained his mind from early days to look upon every problem as an opportunity. In fact, I've known him to say he welcomed tight corners if only to see how God would get him out of them. Bicycles, cried the trader. So you mean to say you're going to bicycle through the jungle? Certainly, said C.T. We will get to the other end more quickly, and when they can't carry us, we will carry them. He had an answer for everything and a faith big enough for any situation. On the incredible trek across the continent, they faced cannibals, wild animals, tropical diseases, the maddening zing of mosquitoes and strange night sounds, the fierce Balinga tribe who had killed Emin Pasha. They were warned that they would never get to the Balinga tribe alive. Hair-raising experiences such as that of an English elephant hunter who'd recently been shot with a poisoned arrow by the Balinga and died failed to deter C.T. and Alfred. They'll be too interested in the bicycles to do anything to us, he said. Massive trees so tall that they turned the midnight sunshine to twilight. Vegetation steamed with heat. Monkeys swung and gibbered at them. The myriad sounds of tiny insects and birds and creaking branches, they felt as though a thousand eyes were staring through the thick bushes watching. They were lost in the primeval forest. They met cannibals with teeth filed to sharp points. They suffered repeated bouts of fever. CT referred to fevers as like being repeatedly dunked by the devil. The fever mounted, the weakness increased, all medicines failed. If they're only sick, let them call for the elders of the church and let them anoint him with oil. But where's the oil? Neither salad, olive oil, the rooms of the altar we possess, but what's the matter with lamp oil? Why not? It's oil, and that's all the book says. We can't afford to be reminded, CT said. This I know, next morning, that whereas I was sick nigh to death, now I was healed. They travelled through the Ituri forest, where Stanley once travelled. The forest was very beautiful in places, like marching through an endless cathedral. They travelled through territory where a Belgian officer with a troop of soldiers had been massacred to the last man by the cannibals. To these very cannibals, CT and Alfred now preached. Their first baptism took place in crocodile-infested river. And while the missionaries were baptizing the candidates, they were also having to find the water to keep the crocodiles at bay. So imagine baptizing with one hand and shooting with the other. As he suffered malaria and other attacks, he wrote, "Some like to live within sound of church or chapel bell. I want to run a rescue shop within a yard of hell." In 1916, C.T. Studd left England for the last time, taking with him a party of eight missionaries, including his young daughter, Edith, who was coming out to marry her fiancé, Alfred Buxton, whom she had finally forgiven, and later another daughter, Pauline, with her husband, Norman Grubb, joined the mission. Soon the number of missionaries had grown to 40. Edith Buxton described herself as a reluctant missionary indeed. When she was 24, she joined her father on the SS Elizabeth to travel through to the Congo and marry Alfred Buxton. "I'll die. I know I will die. I shan't be able to stick it," she wrote in her diary. At one of the first services in the Congo, she remembers the words of one hymn. "Death cometh once. Hear now his tread. Soon shall you and I be lying, each within a narrow bed." She remembered wondering, which one of us will death pick on first? During the eventful four-month journey up the Congo River, Edith lost her engagement ring while flinging out the water from a wash basin overboard, and my engagement ring flew off my hand, plumped at the mighty Congo River. She felt this was a bad omen. "More than 4 years had passed since I'd last seen Alfred," she wrote. "Immediately I held my breath, so acute was the anticipation, the dread of what I might feel. However, the reunion was warm and better than anything she could have expected." After the river journey, there was another month on foot just to reach the mission station. If you were to draw a line through the centre of Africa from north to south and again from east to west, there would be Nama, which is where her father had placed his mission. Edith found Nala a clean, tidy, well-spaced village, avenues of palms grown years ago by Belgians, interspersed with small and big houses, a church and a schoolhouse. They built of mud and thatch in the simplest fashion, and all of this had been Alfred's work. And into the bargain, he had completed the first stage of writing the Balanga, the Bangala vocabulary. They sometimes traveled by canoe and passed herds of hippopotamus. Then they had to trek to Nyangara, where the Belgian district commissioner was waiting to conduct the first white wedding in the heart of Africa. So far, the Belgian officials had not permitted to have their wives with them, because this part of the country is not considered civilized enough, meaning safe enough. Father was quite blatantly unconventional. The church at home, he had thought, had become more of a building than a way of life. He had not been ordained. He read in his Bible, which was his constant guide as to how early Christians went about things, and he would do the same. So that he baptized, he dedicated, he married, and he gave communion. He buried them in the simple African village church. Morning prayers were at 7 a.m. when the whole village returned. Work began at 7:30 or so. They would raise the roof for the hymns of Moody and Sankey translated into Bangala. Once a man got up and told us a story with such relish that every head turned in his direction. "I was so interested," she wrote. "I whispered to Alfred, 'What is he saying?' Alfred replied, He's just told us he's sorry, he has to confess that he's eaten his apple. The prayer meeting every Friday night was a thing to remember. Outside in the dark, the palm trees rustled gently in the evening breeze. Inside, you could see 200 bowed figures, their oiled bodies shining in the light of the palm oil lamps. Gemisi, the converted cannibal and ex-soldier, was the church warden. He would take it upon himself the duty of prowling around, and if by any chance he caught someone with their eyes open, he'd give the heads a good duck and told them, that's no way to behave in God's house. When a man went on praying too long, carried away by the new wonderful experience of talking to God, my father would say, now let us sing a hymn while our brother finishes. Father always said that as long as the missionaries traveled first class, lived out of tins and ate bread and butter, drank tea, the world would never be evangelized. So we learned from the Africans how to make oil from flying ants. We also made sugar from sugarcane. We looked to making packing cases into furniture. We were always warned not to get so posh that it would make barriers between us and the Africans. Aside from cannibals, there was the occasional incident with leopards, crocodiles, and snakes. And after a leopard sees somebody, C.T. Studd took to sleeping with a pistol under his pillow. At the end of the second year in Africa, Edith's daughter Susan was born. And C.T. Studd took an original precaution. He had an arrangement with the drummer of each village between Nala and Nyangara, where the only doctor was. And after Susan was born, Africans swarmed to see her, gazing pop-eyed on the first white baby they'd ever seen. Susan was a very aware child. On one of our journeys by canoe, she shrieked like a 16-year-old every time we shot the rapids and whirled into cascading torrents. Can you imagine taking your little toddler in canoes on those sort of rivers? Ganuta was a big, strong Azandi who walked 200 miles to come and hear about God. I've always wanted to know about God. So my wife and I packed up at once and here we are. When is the first lesson? We never missed a meeting. Whether it was the early morning one with the workmen or the Friday night prayer meeting or the Sunday services. He was always there, sitting quietly with an intent look on his face. Soon he was taking part in the prayer meetings. His prayers were short and eager words. I felt the presence of God among us in the quiet night. He rose quickly to become a leader, finally the head of the boys' school. Edith also relates the story of a man at Ibambi who had died and was being carried to his grave when he sat up with cries of terror, everyone scattered in every direction. The man told the story. I've been with God. He knew my name and that I'd heard the gospel at Ibambi. God said, you shall go back to your village for 10 days. Send for the preacher, accept the message, and then you will come back to me. 10 days later, he declared, now I'm going back to God. And then he simply laid down and died. Shabori, an Azandi chief, lived near Nala, related to Alfred one night, many years before the missionaries had arrived. God met him in his sleep and said, white people will come. They will come with a message from me. Listen carefully and do what they tell you. Until then, only do what is right. There are books like Norman Grubb produced this with C.T. Studd in the Congo forest, which have got many interesting pictures, like on the rapids in the River Welly, these dugout canoes, and a woman of the Miji tribe with interesting headdress, and a chief near Nala, and Samba, the first Nala Christian. A map showing the area of northeastern Congo occupied by the heart of African mission. And there's the different bases that they set up from Nala, Nyangara, Ibambi. These are all the key places where C.T. Studd and his Heart of Africa mission established themselves. An African home in a forest in the background of banana trees. Now these are charred, head-bound, a custom common to most tribes, thinking elongated heads look a bit like foot bindings or things. Mama Yangu, one of Congo's greatest Christians as a blacksmith. The small photo shows him as a non-professional, unpaid Christian leader. Another man, Mai, had no ears. One day Edith could restrain her curiosity no longer and she asked, Mai, where are your ears? Madam, I've eaten them. Eaten them? I exclaimed in astonishment. Yes, eaten them, said Mai calmly. Long years ago, I was a slave in the chief's village. My life was hard. I did much work. I was never paid. One day, I talked with one of the chief's wives, and together we decided to run away. The chief sent the soldiers after us. A big pot was put to boil, and I saw the woman laid on the ground and dismembered limb by limb. and put into the pot to boil before her own still conscious eyes. Slowly she is caught and boiled to be eaten, and then it was my turn next. Suddenly into the circle came the chief's head wife. Gesticulating widely, she says, "Oh, chief, it is not good to eat a child. Curses will come upon us. We shall die." My fate was turned, and instead the chief gave judgment that I was to eat my own ears. Oh, mama, it was terrible, and I was very, very ill for days. On one Sunday evening, word arrived that Nancy from the girls' school had been caught by the chief, Abiyangama, on the way back to school. He has kept her prisoner. We have already been to the village to demand her back, but he will not let her go. "Nothing appealed to my father more than an adventure of this kind," said Edith. He immediately ordered the alarm to be blown on the bugle in the center of the parade ground. It was not long before all the Christians of the village poured out. Father, on the top of the steps, addressed the eager crowd. He was no pacifist, but on this occasion he ordered everyone to lay down their weapons and to go to rescue Nancy as Christians, not as soldiers. There was a murmur of disappointment in the crowd. It must have been an hour's trek through the forest before we came to the chief's village. But long before our arrival, we had heard the drums beating and the grunting cries of the dancers, and as we approached, we saw a circle of about 200 men dancing, oiled bodies gleaming, bunch of feathers on every head. They swayed in time to the drums. Father ordered his men to break through the circle, and we all poured in after him. They stopped opposite the chief, and Father seized the chief by the beard, demanding the return of Nancy. The chief backed away, saying, "I'll fetch her, I'll fetch her." But Father, not to be taken in, followed in pursuit. The Christians fell upon the tribesmen with their bare fists. There was never heard such a thumping and pounding. In the darkness, all he could see was feathers of warriors and flying shirt tails of the Christians as they laid into one another. One of the chief's wives made her way on all fours through the melee of legs until she reached Father, when she quickly took his little finger in her teeth and bit it as only a cannibal can. I gave her a thump which sent her sprawling in the dust. Nancy took advantage of the noise to escape back to Nala. I mean, where do you get missionary stories like this? I mean, this Edith Buxton, she writes the most intriguing, incredible insights into another world and another life. As Edith said, there's no place like Africa finding out. An inner voice begins to speak. What are you doing? When man listens, God speaks. God can speak to the human soul through the enlightened conscience. I began to put things right as far as I could see, and with my obedience to what I believed God was calling and trying to say to me, there came a change, a sense of God's presence. I experienced a new peace and relaxation in the battle of life. She described Alfred as, with such quick intelligence, able to work 16 hours a day, able to eat anything and sleep anywhere, do without anything. We had 6 years of complete and happy companionship. But after his illness, it seems that he had epilepsy, there followed 16 years of ever-deepening anxiety, sleepless nights and further attacks, which Alfred took for the silence and the courage that was complete. Father had made such sacrifice of himself that it was in his nature to expect much from others, and most of us could not keep up with him. If missionaries did not come up to scratch, Father felt we had better rid of him. Alfred played the part of a peacemaker. The same thing happened in cases where African Christians had fallen into sin. Father would demand the necessity of church discipline. Alfred would advocate patience and love. Each was representing the truth of the gospel, but the differences became severe. Without holiness, no man shall see the Lord. Father had been trained in law, and his letters could be very severe. He would not be put off his calling by anyone, even his wife. My father once said, "You need only 1 inch of theology for every foot of practical Christian living." At age 70, C.T. mastered Kingwana and was able over the years to progress in a translation of the New Testament, the Psalms, and extracts from the Proverbs into Kingwana. In 1828, C.T. Studd wrote, "As I believe I'm now nearing my departure from this world, I have but a few things to rejoice in, and they are these. Number one, that God called me to China and I went, in spite of utmost opposition from all my loved ones. Number two, that I joyfully acted as Christ had told the rich young man to act. I would sell everything you've got, give it away. Number three, that I deliberately at the call of God when alone gave up my life for this work, which was to henceforth not only be for the Sudan only, but for the whole unevangelized world. My only joys are therefore that when God has given me work to do, I have not refused it. To the end, Charles maintained a strenuous routine. He worked an 18-hour day. He undertook long journeys. He preached sometimes to congregations of 2,000. He read the Bible for hours each day, and he poured his heart into prayer. Then the news that his wife, who had been left behind England because of ill health, had died. She maintained the mission base back home while he was in Congo. Charles now suffered several heart attacks and gallstones. In July 1931, this gallant, unconventional cricketer's innings came to an end. In 1931, in the Atura forest, where he had once been entertained by cannibals, he died. He died the good soldier he had lived, surrounded by the African people he loved, and whose lives he had done so much to change. It was a stormy day when they laid him to rest. 2,000 people from the surrounding forest came to his funeral, including the chiefs. In assessing this incredible, bold, abrasive, controversial missionary, his co-workers, including his sons-in-law, Alfred Buxton and Norman Grubb, recognized that his energy and his earnestness and his single-mindedness made him a most difficult person to work with. He was stubborn, and he wasn't flexible in what he required and demanded of others. He was eccentric. He wrote a booklet in which he said he didn't give a damn about anything except to serve Christ and save souls. And he had the DCD, was what he put often behind his initials. DCD, don't care a damn. This kind of language was most offensive and unacceptable to many people at that time. Here's a Victorian and Edwardian England. I cannot abide cowardice, he wrote. I refuse to make my God and Savior a non-entity. He was ruthless in the standards he set for himself and for others, and he interpreted leisure and recreation as idleness. He laid a powerful emphasis on the need for holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. People were not sure what to make of a man who, in his 50s, could leave behind an ailing wife, while he went to be a missionary in the most inaccessible part of the earth. His love for Jesus Christ was supreme, and to many of his contemporaries, he was a fanatic. In fact, that's the name of one of the books on him, Fool and Fanatic. And as he said, everyone was happy for me to be a cricket fan, and fan is only short for fanatic. So I could be a fanatic for cricket. That was fine. That was respectable. But to be a fanatic for Jesus and for missions, that is considered unacceptable socially. The mission he founded, Worldwide Evangelization Crusade, has grown to be one of the largest missions in the world today. We'll have changed the name to Worldwide Evangelization for Christ, because crusade is considered politically incorrect and could offend someone. Well, Charles Studdon wouldn't have cared a damn about offending anyone's feelings, just to quote him. The life of C.T. Studd will always remain a challenge to those who seek an easier path. Before the world, aye, before the sleepy, lukewarm, faithless, namby-pamby Christian world, we will dare to trust our God, we will venture our all for him, we will live and we will die for him, and we will do it with his joy unspeakable, singing aloud in our hearts. That's one of the quotes of C.T. Studd. C.T. Studd's life stands as some rugged Gibraltar wrote his daughter, a sign to all succeeding generations that it is worthwhile to lose all this world can offer and stake everything on the world to come. His life will be an eternal rebuke to easygoing Christianity. He has demonstrated what it means to follow Christ without counting the cost and without looking back. C.T. was essentially a cavalry leader, and in that capacity he led several splendid charges. When C.T. and Stanley Smith went with the Cambridge 7 to China in 1885. 10 years later, when C.T. Studd toured the universities at the start of the student volunteer movement. And in 1910, when he initiated the campaign for the region between the Nile and the Lake Chad, the largest unevangelized region in Africa at that time. These three things alone have affected missionary history. He personified the heroic spirit, the apostolic abandon. From him, I learned that God's idea of a saint is not a man primarily concerned with his own sanctification. God's saint is 50% a soldier. Anyone can be brave once. It is sticking to it that counts. There's a price to be paid for dedicated, selfless service, such as Father and Alfred gave to Africa. Her husband, Alfred Buxton, later went to Abyssinia and was involved in translating the Bible into the Ethiopian Amharic language. This is one of many great books on C.T. Studd, C.T. Studd, Athlete and Pioneer. Another book is Fool and Fanatic. These books were compulsory reading at Hospital Christian Fellowship, the first mission I worked at. Francis Grimm regularly quoted from Hudson Taylor and C.T. Studd, and C.T. Studd was definitely his favorite. And we would be regaled with stories of C.T. Studd around the dinner table, lunch table, supper table, and at prayer meetings. And C.T. Studd was often referred to when rebuking any kind of lack of zeal on our part. Let us not glide through this world and then slip quietly into heaven without having blown the trumpet loud and long for our Redeemer, Jesus Christ. Another quote from C.T. Studd. Christ did not die to whitewash us. He died to recreate us, and none but his recreations enter heaven. And the most famous quote, which we all should know from C.T. Studd, you only have one life. It will soon be passed. Only what's done for Jesus Christ will last. So, the story of C.T. Studd is on our Frontline Mission Essay.org website. It's one of the chapters in our Greatest Century of Missions book, which everyone at GC has as a textbook. Examples of excellence. Well, C.T. Studd, the cricketer for Christ, certainly gives us an example of excellence. And the books that have been produced on him stand as absolutely refreshing, unnerving, shocking kinds of books. He was unlike any other. But his daughter, Edith Buxton, must have written what rates as one of my favorite missionary books of all time. I read this early on my Christian walk and was, wow, what a brutally honest and hilarious missionary author who gave an insight to missions and another world that others were either not able to or not willing to give. I mean, she gives it all there. She just gives you an insight to another world that we would not know but for this kind of honest mission. She doesn't put a veneer. She doesn't beat around the bush. She tells it straight. And I must have lent this book, and in all my hitchhiking around, I lost it. And years later, in 2005, when I was invited to minister in Northern Ireland with Dr. Ian Paisley, one day he said, I've got a treat for you, after all the different works. We went to a second-hand bookshop, and he said, help yourself, take whatever you want, and I'll box them up and ship them back to Africa for you. Because I still had another 10 countries to go through in Europe, another month on the field. And how thoughtful is that of a host? One of the best places in the world to get second-hand bookshops is in Great Britain. And I found a copy of this book, Reluctant Missionary, which I had lost my copy who knows how many years before. So I got that again, and I didn't dare to let it go into the box in the mail. I carried it with me through Romania, Eastern Europe, and everywhere else that I was going on that mission, and read it again, and it inspired me to put together this presentation, because I think we need insights from these great times. I mean, here's somebody who thought her father was crazy a lot of her life, but in the end she joined him. And again, Alfred Buxton, what an amazing person. I've been to his home also in England, which today is an international Bible college. But there's so much that can be said about these great cricketers, and what a family, what a heritage, what an amazing gifted athlete and pioneering mission. So, C.T. Studd's also Victorious Christians Who Changed the World. One of the heroes of the faith in the audio. So, questions, comments. Anyone want to comment on C.T. Studd? Ryan.
Dr. Hamlet, can you please explain how C.T. Studd dealt with opposition during his time in China, either from the native Chinese or from his fellow missionaries?
Well, he certainly had a sense of humor, which was essential, he said. You cannot survive in China without a good sense of humor, because it is quite discouraging when the people are so xenophobic, so hostile, so abusive and insulting. But 10 years in China, that must have been hard. That was the hardest mission field for him, was China. India was easy, and Congo, I think, was the joy of his life. He enjoyed the Congo more than any other. He really loved Africa. And so I think the time in China was a great sacrifice. It was hard work, very little response adequately. I mean, he had converts, he had some progress, but nothing compared to what he had in Africa. In Africa, thousands came to Christ. In China, it was scores for a lot of work. So how did he cope with it? He must have toughened his skin that he was not allowing people's criticism to get to him. But the Chinese were very closed, because Africans are very warm. So I think he went from the coldest to the Indians, who are a lot friendlier, to Africans, who are the most friendly of all. So he was, his mission fields improved, even if his health did not. But how about that? Somebody who was told, you can't go to the field. You're too sick. Didn't stop him, still went. Quite a character. Got to be about the most unconventional of all the missionaries, actually.
How long, when he was in Sudan, were there any North African Arabs in the land?
Or well, just they were coming. So when he started, when he went in 1910, he came down the Nile. So he started on the Mediterranean through Egypt into Sudan, which at that stage was controlled by the British. And so that's why he linked up with the church missionaries. And he seriously considered planting his mission station in Maridi, where I started my work actually in Sudan. It was just inside Equatoria, in Western Equatoria. But the malaria was too bad there, and he went a bit further over the border into what was Belgian Congo, and he found Nala, and he thought that was better. The malaria was not as bad as it was in Sudan. So the Arabs hadn't got that far down. They weren't there yet. But of course the goal was a chain of mission stations to prevent the southward expansion of Islam. That was the strategy. So he went through Sudan. He went through all Arabic areas. He was well aware of what was going on in Sudan. Interesting though, at that point Sudan was referred to pretty widely. So the Congo and Sudan seems a bit of an overlap. He wasn't a Belgian Congo, but he still referred to it often as Sudan. Sudan meant the hinterland of Africa, basically. So it was a bit of a broad term. Yes, John.
With his mission, the period he was in China, did it sort of, it seems as if it overlapped a bit with the William Kelly?
No, it's very different.
Okay.
Because William Carey was focused in India, and he was a Baptist denominational mission. So William Carey launched the denominational missions. Hudson Taylor launched the interdenominational faith missions, which were concerned with the hinterland. So CT Studd, you could see he had adopted more of Hudson Taylor's approach. Interdenominational faith mission, male, female, single, not only married, could be involved. You could be a lay person. William Carey would have expected his missionaries to all have Bible college theological training of some sort and so on, and be committed to denomination. So C.T. Studd is following the Hudson Taylor model, but he's adapting it. If anything, he's being even more radical. If Hudson Taylor was radical, C.T. Studd was even more radical. In a good sense, radical. Other comments, observations, questions?
Did C.T. Studd have a theological training?
No. No, he had training in law and cricket. And he's a cricketer with legal training. And he's an honored Cambridge graduate, but no theological training. And the thing that's so bizarre about him is, unlike almost any of the other missionaries that you can think of at that time, he never bothered to join any church. And he's just so unconventional. He's such a character. And his daughter comments along the line, the insights into him, he really was exactly the way he spoke. He said what he meant what he said, he was blunt, he was forthright. He ran roughshod over everyone else's opinions, even his own family's. And they're all standing around saying, you know, what on earth is he up to? This is insane. But as she said, she reluctantly, in the end, grew to love and respect and support and join her dad's mission, which hence the title, Reluctant Mission.
Yes.
Books like that need to be reprinted, actually. I mean, it's just so great that there are books like that out there, and I've never heard anyone else refer to it. Just a gem I came across early on in my Christian walk and rediscovered Northern Ireland. But where do you get insights into missions like that? You can't even compare. What I learned from Norman Grubb's book on C.T. Studd is just a shadow of what I learned from Edith Buxton's insights. She's such a gifted writer, but it's just so funny. And I just gave some selections here. And you can imagine, there's a lot more. But the whole thing, nothing was uninteresting. It's just what a fascinating insight into an extraordinary life. And you wonder what else there is in the Great Ascension Missions that we don't know about. So that's why I like digging out these old books that aren't very popular, they're not in the mainstream, but they give us an insight to another world and to different ways of thinking. Because I think a lot of books today are like on a narrative where they try to repeat certain themes and fit in with the modern narratives and not make people feel too uncomfortable. Well, that didn't seem to bother either Buxton. She was quite happy to make people feel uncomfortable. I mean, who gives testimonies about eating their uncle and eating their ears and things like that? Or thumping some chief's daughter who's biting her dad's finger and knocking her lights out with a punch. You don't think of girls who've gone to finishing school in Switzerland behaving like that. But there we go. This is part of our history and our heritage, and we need to treasure our heritage. And also it should challenge us that we can step out of our comfort zone and go into some strange situations. Because, you know, who would have blamed C.T. Studd after 10 years in China, being invalid back, if he never went back to the field? Who would have blamed him if after India he never went out again? His doctor said he wasn't fit enough. And yet he went again, and what he achieved in the Congo outshadowed everything he did in China and India combined. And it's to this day, the fruit remains. There's a lot of Christians in the Congo. It's a phenomenal achievement.
Another question regarding the mission stations that he wants to build across the center of Africa. Did he succeed in that goal?
Well, he succeeded. WEC particularly succeeded in the Congo, and others like Africa Inland Mission, particularly in Kenya and Uganda, and then the Sudan Interior Mission, interestingly enough, was very strong in Nigeria. Again, they used the word Sudan very broadly. So yes, it was succeed. Different missions took different sections, but basically it kept Islam north for about a century. And it's pretty sad that in the 1960s, the World Council Churches called for moratorium in missions, and many of these denominational missions withdrew the missionaries. Like when they withdrew the Scarboroughs from the Gilbert Islands and London Missionary Society closed down, just pulled all the missionaries from field. Islam has advanced dramatically since that so-called moratorium in missions, which was called at Uppsala, World Council Churches gathering in Sweden in 1968. Catastrophe, absolute moral catastrophe. The same time that the Protestant Film Office, which was monitoring all the films in Hollywood, closed down because they thought $70,000 a year was too much budget. And from that time, Hollywood went like no holds barred. There was the motion picture code that governed films before 1967. But in 1968, the Protestant Film Office, the National Council of Church of America, decided to close down their monitoring, which was advising and guiding the film producers on moral standards to adhere to. So there was no cruelty to animals, there's no blasphemy, there's nothing derogatory about people's faith, that crime never paid, that there's a whole lot of standards that they had to adhere to. And if they didn't get that seal of approval from church, then church people would boycott the films. And Hollywood was very concerned not to upset the Protestant Film Office. And the Catholics had the Catholic Legion of Decency. When did they close down?
It was around the same time.
Yes. So in the 1960s, you had this retreat, which the World Council Church and National Council Church is basically engineered. And there's this retreat from Christian influence around the world, and you could just see a collapse of Christian morals, and the floodgates of hell were opened up in many ways. And we could see the end result in, for example, Sudan. The Sudan government closed down missions in Sudan, 1964, kicked out all the missionaries there. Then, I mean, that's bad enough when jihadist governments close down missions, but when the missions themselves close down the missions, when local people are pleading with them to stay, like in the Gilbert Islands and and the missionaries were just forced to leave, we're pulling it all back. Because the World Council Church has decreed there should be a moratorium on missions. As though, well, I don't think the Lord Jesus has ever rescinded the Great Commission, but some human agencies have tried to do it for him. We must obey God rather than man.
He came from Eton. It's interesting, you know, even now, Eton and Harrow is the most coveted school probably on the planet. And that's what a huge difference it is seeing the people of that time, the product of that time, compared to now. I mean, I think Boris Johnson went to Eton and wouldn't even consider himself a Christian at all.
Hmm.
How much they've lost the war on the home front.
You know? Yes, sir.
So it's always the recurring theme, you know, going out to the mission and then losing the war at the home front.
Yes.
You know, it's really not good. And Cambridge and Oxford, too, they've also gone down this secular humanist on steroids type of outlook. And without they produce any decent Christian.
Yes. So, I challenge everyone to get the copy of A Chocolate Soldier, read C.T. Studd's message, A Chocolate Soldier. It's really just hard-hitting, no-nonsense type of speaking. It's just incredible to think that you used to have athletes and celebrities who spoke like that. And you can imagine the shock he was to the system. And going to Cambridge, imagine one of their graduates coming to speak and all the professors walk out in protest when he's speaking. That's just extraordinary. Because how many people rock the boat these days? To rock the boat to that extent that the faculty are make a silent protest. But these days, the faculty wouldn't walk out. They would throw out the speaker. So again, at least there was still a freedom of speech that he could give his message, which was very subversive, you could say, of the powers that be. Because he was speaking out against comfortable Christianity and selfish, soft, sentimental, namby-pamby, squishy Christians, as he called them. And he wanted people to have backbone. We've got even jellyfish today, is the term I use, filleted of spine.
One friend in high school said, people have become softer than marshmallows.
Softer than marshmallows. That's well said. So, you know, when we speak about evangelicals becoming even jellyfish, you know, jellyfish have no spine. So we speak about these people who've been filleted of their doctrinal spine. They no longer believe anything, so they fall for anything. They don't stand for anything. They fall for anything. So, any other questions, comments? John?
With your dream of sort of, in fact, let's start with the GCC. The GCC is there to sort of train people for 3 weeks towards missions.
Mm-hmm.
And taking the example of Stad, who seemed not to have any background of GCC training or any way of salvation training, but he entered into mission and was very successful. What would you say?
Yes, well, bear in mind that he was a strong, physically strong sportsman. He had a very powerful conversion through the D.L. Moody time, and it was a time of revival. There was a great evangelical awakening. They called it the Second Great Evangelical Awakening in the 1850s, 1860s in the British Isles, and he was affected by it. And then there was another wave in the 1880s. And so he was caught up in those revivals and heard some of the greatest preachers of the time. And then he was trained under Hudson Taylor, who was an extraordinary missionary. I mean, think, he worked for 10 years under Hudson Taylor in Sudan, in China. And then after that, he was launching the mission into Africa. So it's not that he went with no training. He got 10 years in China, a lot of which must have been just tough training, really, if you think about it. Because what a hard mission field at the best of times. But the sacrifices made by the missionaries in the 19th century in China has brought forth the phenomenal fruit that today we have got at least 140 million Christians in China today. It's just mind-boggling.
And the Chinese Communist Party was smaller. Just whatever, 100 million members.
Yes.
So there are more Christians than there are members of the Chinese.
There's more Christians in China than there are communists in the Communist Party of China, yes. There's also more Christians in China than there are Christians in the United States of America. Now, of course, percentage-wise, there's a larger number of Christians in the United States than there are in China, but numbers-wise, China is the largest nation on earth, but 140 million Christians in China? In a country where it's not socially acceptable to be a Christian? That's phenomenal. That's really amazing. And it's even more amazing when you consider that when the Chinese Communist Party seized China, 1849 and 1949, there were barely 3 million Christians in all of China. That's counting the Catholics, Protestants, everyone. Barely 3 million. And they were all wiped out, or at least it was believed they were wiped out in the great leap forward of the Cultural Revolution, 1960s. Cultural Revolution, China, 1966 to 1968. So about the same time as West was retreating, Chinese Communist Party was advancing. And it was believed, when I was converted in 1977, it was believed that the church in China was extinct. And I remember a person from Overseas Missionary Fellowship coming past Pines Baptist Church and telling us to pray for the church in China. And I remember some people snorting and saying, what church in China? There are no Christians left in China. And it was general talk amongst the Christians, like in my church, that, what's he talking about? No Christians could have survived the Cultural Revolution. And when Mao Zedong died, and when we went a bit further, suddenly word was coming out, there's millions of Christians in China. There's over 100 million Christians in China. And it was like, this is not possible. And Brother Andrew, of God Smuggler fame, came as a guest to Hospital Christian Fellowship a number of times. And so I remember before I went into the army, 1979, I was at HGF and Brother Andrew came as a guest speaker. And he told us that we know of something like 100 million Christians in China and they need Bibles. And he's preparing Project Pearl to smuggle 1 million Bibles into China, which he did the next year, 1980. And remember, 1 million Bibles being smuggled into China? How on earth is that possible? Do you know how much 1 million Bibles is? That's 1 million kilograms. Each Bible is about 1 kilogram on average. So, you know, just think of the logistics. But he succeeded, by the way, in doing that. And so, as Brother Andrew was talking about this, where have these Christians come from? I mean, there's been no missionaries in China since 1948. Christianity is illegal. Bibles banned. China's locked down, total persecution. Where did all these Christians come from? Under such persecution, it's the most remarkable thing, but it just shows the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. God has not forsaken the sacrifices of the Hudson Taylors and all the great missionaries who poured their heart and soul, Gladys Hale with many others into China, Robert Morrison, you can go back as far as you want. And a lot of sacrifice in the 19th century, but the fruit came in the latter part of the 20th century. And today, nobody can crush the Chinese church. It's huge. Bigger than the church in America, bigger than the Communist Party of China. I mean, just think of that. That is something to just stagger the imagination. And make no mistake, I've heard the Chinese Communist Party is terrified of the church. Because they know the church brought down the Communist Party of Russia, the Communist Party of Romania, and of all of Eastern Europe. They are terrified that the church in China will replace them.
Peter, could you just comment on this? I mean, I read some time ago that the church in the West and in the United States hasn't been growing that much. It's more static. And then on the other side of it is that where the demographics are growing in certain areas of the world, you know, the populations are rising. That it's in these countries that the church is growing rapidly. And so that the net, there's been a tremendous net gain in Christians around the world.
That is what Patrick Johnson is saying of Operation World. The statistics are that we're living in one of the greatest incomings of the church. The latter half of the 20th century, especially since the 1970s, seen phenomenal growth in church growth, mainly in the third world. So-called third world, what they call the global south.
Yeah, because, you know, the thing is that there can be some sort of despondency, people thinking of what's happening to the church, etc., etc., but that's actually the opposite.
Yes, there's a lot of reasons to be concerned if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, in Western Europe, in the NATO countries. There's been a lot of loss of ground. But just take Germany, for example. In a 10-year period, again, I'm taking Operation World Statistics. Patrick Johnson's the world's top missiologist, so he's got the statistics. In one 10-year period, 1,000 churches were closed in Germany. But that was 700 Catholic churches and 300 Lutheran churches. But during the same 10 years, 1,500 new churches were planted. And they were all Bible-believing, evangelical, born-again churches. So, yes, a lot of established churches who are in apostasy are closing. But there's a new groundswell of church planting. So even in a place that's been as secularized as Germany, the church growth is very heartening. And the statistics, again, I'm going a few years back now, but there were at least 4,000 Muslims coming to Christ every year in Germany at that time. A lot of it from student ministry. So there's some surprising advances in even some of the most unexpected areas. But the fastest church growth throughout all of Europe is in Russia. The church in Russia is growing there. They were building 200 church buildings in Moscow alone at one time. That's, again, a few years ago statistics. But Russia's gone from less than 200 church buildings open in 1941 to over 30,000 congregations just of the Russian Orthodox Church alone, not counting thousands of others of other denominations. So the church growth in Russia in the last 30 years has just been stupendous. Bible colleges, hundreds of Bible colleges, so many seminaries. It's just phenomenal growth. So all over Eastern Europe, there's great church growth, with one exception. The Czech Republic is one place in Eastern Europe where the gospel has not grown. They are frozen at about 1% of the population are evangelicals. But with the exception of the Czech Republic, the rest of Eastern Europe, the church growth has been explosive. So, any other comments, observations? Of course, we're mainly focusing on China and the Congo tonight and CT Stud.
So the question, does he have any relatives that are involved in evangelism to this day? Any of the offspring?
I'm sure he does, but remember he had daughters, so yeah, you won't get the name. But the Buxtons are very involved. In fact, funny that the Buxton home, Sherborne, in England, I went there and spoke at the Bible College. It's a massive international Bible College, beautiful, old, stately British home, which has been turned from this family that was horrified that their son was going off with this harebrained man, and now their home is an international Bible College. And so many good things like this. So, yes, there's no doubt that the families, his descendants are involved, but they're not using the surname of Stud because he had four daughters.
Did the Great War have any effects on his ministry?
Well, this is the fascinating thing. While everyone else was heading off to the Great War, C.T. Studd was not even tempted to get involved in this worthless waste of time, in destroying souls instead of winning souls. And he saw opening up the front in Africa to win souls as far more important than wasting his life as supporting this useless Western front. So he was scathing in the amount of young men wasting their time going off to fight for what in France? head into the Congo and the heart of Africa and fight for souls. So very impressive that C.T. Studd did not allow himself to get derailed. And also, as we mentioned the other day about William Townsend, Cameron Townsend, the founder of Wycliffe Bible Translators, when he was tempted to go off and join the war in Europe in 1917, when a lot of other American youth were doing it, an old military veteran said, don't waste your time on the battlefield, go into the mission field. And redirect, and out that came Wycliffe Bible Translators. So the war affected them in the sense that the support was much less than it should have been. And the fact that the amount of volunteers was much harder. But C.T. Studd was not, it's like he was so laser focused he would not get distracted by these things. But that must have been phenomenal, because the hysteria in Britain towards every male has to get involved in this war. Every woman should support the cause and get in the factories. And But the Stud family, they did not budge. So good for them. The battle for souls is far more important battle than any of these other wars that the world can come out with. And how often have we not found a lot of these wars that the world is trumping as the war to end all wars, or war for freedom, and we found out later they were lying to us anyway. So, I must say, I don't regret getting involved in the Lord's battles, but there's a lot of the world's battles that you found out later were smoke and mirrors and deception.